their crushed bodies. Holston looked over just as they spotted one more ant up on the consoles.
"Don't smash the electronics," Lane warned. "We may need..." Was that a flame?
There was a brief flash and flare at the ant's abdomen, which it was directing aggressively towards them. Aiming was the word that came to Holston's mind. Then that end of the cabin was on fire. The crew reeled back from the sudden jet of flame that sprayed burning chemicals across the confined space. Nessel fell back over Holston and Tevik, beating at her arm. Suddenly, there was a line of fire between them and the airlock, leaping absurdly high, seeming to burn fiercer and faster than there was any reason for. And the ant was still spewing it out. Now, the plastics of the consoles were melting, filling the air with throat-catching fumes. Lane lurched to the rear, coughing, and slapped at one of the panels, hunting for an emergency release. Holston realized that she was trying to open the shutters to the hold, or where the hold had been. A moment later, the back wall of the cabin irised out into open space, and Lane almost fell through. Scholes and Nessel went straight out with Tevik between them, and Lane hauled up Holston under the armpits and helped him follow. "The ants," he managed. Scholes was already looking around, but somehow the great host of insects they had seen earlier appeared to have disintegrated in just the few moments they were inside. Instead of the purposeful coalescing of an insect horde, there were now just little knots of fighting insects all around, turning on one another or just wandering blankly around. They seemed to have lost all interest in the shuttle. Many were heading back into the trees.
"Did we poison them or something?"
Scholes asked, stamping on the closest just to be on the safe side.
"No idea. Maybe we killed them with our germs."
Lane collapsed next to Holston.
"What next, Chief? Most of our kit's on fire."
Scholes stared about him with the baffled, angry look of a man who has lost control of the last shreds of his own destiny.
"We..."
he started. But no plan followed the word.
"Look,"
said Nessel in a hushed voice. There was something approaching from the tree line, something that was not an ant, bigger and with more legs. It was watching them. There was no other way to put it. It had enormous, great dark orbs, like the eye sockets of a skull. And it approached in sudden fits of movement, a rapid scuttle. Then it was still and regarding them once more. It was a spider, a monster spider, like a bristling, crooked hand. Holston stared at its ragged, hairy body, its splayed legs, the hooked fangs curled beneath it. When his gaze strayed to the two large eyes that made up so much of its front, he felt an unbearable shock of connection, as though it was trespassing on territory he had only ever shared with another human being before. Scholes levelled his pistol, hand shaking.
"Like on the drone recording," Lane said slowly. "Fuck me, it's as long as my arm."
"Why is it watching us?" Nessel demanded. Scholes swore, and then the gun boomed in his hand, and Holston saw the crouching monster spin away in a sudden flurry of convulsing limbs. The mutineer chief's expression was slowly turning to one of despair, that of a man who, it seemed, would next turn the gun on himself.
"What am I hearing?" Nessel asked.
Holston had somehow just thought it was a rolling echo of the gunshot, but now he realized that there was something more, something like thunder. He looked up. He didn't quite believe what he was seeing. There was a shape in the sky. It grew larger as he watched, slowly descending towards them. A moment later, a bright wash of light seared down from it, illuminating the entire crash site in its pale radiance.
"Cast shuttle," Lane breathed. "Never thought I'd be glad to see him."
Holston looked over to Scholes. The man was staring up at the descending vehicle, and who could guess at what bitter, desperate thoughts were passing through his head? The approaching shuttle got to about 10 feet off the ground, jockeyed a little, and then picked a landing site, some way back down the devastated scar that the crash-landing cabin had created. Even as it came down, the side hatch was opening, and Holston saw a trio of figures in security detail armour, two of them with rifles already levelled.
"Drop the weapon,"
boomed Cast's amplified voice.
"Surrender and drop the weapon. Prepare to be evacuated."
Skulls' hand was shaking, and there were tears at the corner of his eyes. But Nessel put a hand on his arm. "It's over," she told him. "We're done here. There's nothing left for us. I'm sorry, Skulls." The mutineer chief gave a final glance around at the looming forest that no longer seemed so wonderfully vibrant and green and earth-like. The shadows seemed to throng with unseen eyes, with chitinous motion. He dropped the pistol disgustedly, a man whose dreams had been shattered.
"Okay, Lane, Mason, you come right over here first. I want to check you're unharmed."
Lane did not hesitate, and Holston shambled after her, feeling only the faintest, deadened sense of pain, yet still having to labour at both breathing and walking, weirdly disconnected from his own body.
"Get in,"
Cast told them. Lane paused in the hatch. "Thank you," she said, without so much of her usual mockery.
"You think I'd leave you here?"
Cast asked her, visor still looking outwards. "I thought Guyon might."
"That's what he wanted them to think."
Lane didn't look convinced, but she helped Holston up after her. "Come on, get your prisoners and let's get out of here."
"No prisoners," Cast stated.
"What?" Holston asked, and then Cast's men started shooting. Both of them had taken Skulls as their first target, and the mutineer leader went down instantly with barely a yell. Then they were turning their guns on the other two. Holston barreled into them, shouting, demanding that they stop.
"What are you doing?" "Orders!"
Cast shoved him back. Holston had a wheeling glimpse of Tevik and Nessel trying to put the crashed cabin between themselves and the rifles. The mutineer pilot fell, struggled to his feet, clutching at his injured leg, and then jerked as one of the security men picked him off. Nessel made it to the tree line and vanished into the deeper darkness there. Holston stared after her, feeling a crawling horror. Would I rather be shot? Surely I would. But it wasn't a choice anyone was asking of him.
"We have to get her back, alive," he insisted. "She's valuable. She's a scholar. She's got..."
"No prisoners. No ringleaders for a future mutiny," Cast told him with a shrug.
"And your woman up there doesn't care, so long as there's no interference to her precious planet."
Holston blinked.
"Kern?" "We're here to clear up the mess for her,"
Cast confirmed.
"She's listening right now. She's got her finger on the switch of all our systems. So it's straight in, straight out."
"You bargained with Kern to come and get us," Lane clarified. Cast shrugged.
"She wanted you out of the picture down here. We wanted you back. We cut a deal. But we need to get going now."
"You can't..." Holston stared out from the hatch at the deep forest beyond. "Call Nessel back just to have her executed?" He subsided, realizing only that, at heart, he was just glad to be safe.
"So, Kern," Cast called out. "What now? I don't much fancy going into that to get her, and I reckon that would just involve more of that interference you don't want."
The clipped, hostile tones of Avrana Kern issued from the comms panel.
"Your inefficiency is remarkable." "Whatever," Cast grunted. "We're coming back to orbit, right? Is that okay?"
"It would seem the least undesirable option at this point," Kern agreed, still sounding disgusted.
"Leave now, and I will destroy the crashed vessel."
"The... she can do that?" Lane hissed. "You mean she could have..."
"It's kind of a one-shot. Got our drone up there under her control," Cast explained. "She's going to stick it into the crash there, and then do some kind of controlled detonation of its reactor. Burn up the wreck without flattening the entire area. Doesn't want her precious monkeys playing with grown-up toys, or something."
"Yeah, well, we didn't see any fucking monkeys," Lane muttered. "Let's get out of here." Chapter 3.10 Giants in the Earth. Portia examines the creature as it sleeps. She was not in time to see any of the momentous,
inexplicable events that left a great burning scar across the face of her world, the fires that are still burning, despite the ant's best efforts to contain them. From others of her kind, she has heard a garbled version of events, crippled by the teller's inability to understand what it is they have witnessed. It will all be remembered, though, through the generations to come. This understanding, this contact with the unknowable, will be one of the most analysed and reinterpreted events of all her species' histories. Something fell from the sky. It was not the messenger, which clearly retains its regular circuit of the heavens, but in the mind of Portia and her kin, it seems linked to that orbiting mote. It is a promise that the skies are host to more than one mobile star, and that even stars may fall. Some hypothesize that it was a herald or forerunner, a message from the messenger, and that if its meaning can only be interpreted, then the messenger will have new lessons to teach. Over the generations, this view, that a test has been set beyond the simple pure manipulation of numbers, will gain in popularity, whilst simultaneously being viewed as a kind of heresy. The events themselves seem inarguable, however. Something fell, and now it is a blackened shell of metals and other unknown materials that defy analysis. Something else came to Earth, and then returned to the sky. Most crucially, there were living things. There were giants that came from the sky. They were fighting off scouts from the ant colony when Portia's people first saw them. Then, when the scouts had been killed or converted, the giants killed one of Portia's own people, one of Bianca's assistants. After they departed, they left some bodies of their own kind, some killed by the ants, others just dead from mysterious wounds. Swift work by Bianca's team removed these remains from the scene, with fortunate timing, given the explosion that occurred soon after, ending any useful inquiry and killing a further handful of Bianca's males. At the time, nobody realised that one of the star creatures had remained alive and entered the forest. Now Portia examines the thing as it appears to sleep. The shape of a human being sparks no ancestral recollection in her. Even had her distant antecedents any memories to pass on, their tiny keyhole's span of vision would have been unable to appreciate the scale of anything so large. Portia herself is having difficulties. The sheer size and bulk of this alien monster give her pause for thought. The creature has already killed two of her kind when it encountered them. They had tried to approach, and the thing had attacked them on sight. Biting it had little or no effect. Being designed for use against spiders, Portia's venom has limited effect against vertebrates. If it was just some monstrous, oversized beast, then to trap and kill it would be relatively simple, Portia decides. If the worst came to the worst, they could simply set the ants on it, as they're obviously more than equal to the task. The mystical significance of this creature is a different consideration, however. It has come from the sky, from the messenger, ergo. It is not a threat to be confronted, but a mystery to be unravelled. Portia feels the thrumming of destiny beneath her feet. She has a sense that everything that is past and everything that is to come are balanced at this point in time. The fulcrum resting within herself, this moment, is one of divinely mandated significance. Here, in its monstrous living form, is some part of the messenger's message. They will trap it. They will capture it and bring it back to Great Nest, using all the artifice and guile at their command. They will find some way to unravel its secret. Portia glances upwards. The canopy of the forest keeps the stars from her view, but she is keenly aware of them. Both the fixed constellations that wheel slowly across the arch of the year, and the messenger's swift spark in the darkness. She thinks of them as her people's birthright, if her people can only understand what they are being told. Her kind has won a great victory over the ants, turning enemies into allies, reversing the tide of the war. From here on, colony after colony will fall to them. Surely, it is in recognition of this, in reward for their cleverness and endurance and success, that the messenger has sent them this sign. With her body twanging with manifest destiny, Portia now plans the capture of her colossal prize. Chapter 3.11. This Island Gulag. From the comms room, Holston watched the last shuttle depart for the moon base, carrying its oblivious human cargo.
Guyon's plan was simple. An active crew of 50 had been woken up and briefed on what was expected, or perhaps demanded, of them. The base was ready for them, everything constructed by the automatics during the Gilgamesh's last long sleep, and tested fit for habitation. It would be the crew's job to keep it running and operational, so as to turn it into a new home for the human race. They would have another 200 in suspension, ready to call on when they needed them, to replace losses, or more hopefully to expand their active population when the base was ready for them. They would have children. Their children would inherit what they had built. At some time in the future, generations later, it was anticipated that the Gilgamesh would return from its long voyage to the next terraforming project, hopefully carrying a cargo of pirated old empire technology that would, as Guyon said, make everyone's lives that much easier. Or enable him to mount an attack on the Kern's satellite and claim her planet, Halston thought. And surely he wasn't alone in thinking that, though nobody was voicing it. If the Gilgamesh did not return, if, say, the next system had a more aggressive guardian than Kern, or some other mishap should befall the Ark ship, then the moon colony would just have to... manage, was the word that Guyon had used. Nobody was going behind that. Nobody wanted to think about the limited range of fates possible for such a speck of human dust in the vast face of the cosmos. The newly appointed leader of the colonists was not another Skulls, certainly. That intrepid woman listened to her orders with grim acceptance. Looking into her face, Halston told himself that he could see a terrible, bleak despair hiding in her eyes. What was she being handed after all? At the worst, a death sentence. At the best, a life sentence. An undeserved penal term that her children would inherit straight from the womb. He started when someone clapped him on the shoulder. Lane. The two of them, along with Cast and his team, had only recently got out of quarantine. The only good out of the whole of Skulls' doomed excursion planetside was that there didn't seem to be any bacteria or viruses down there that posed an immediate danger to human health. And why would there be? As Lane had pointed out, there hadn't seemed to be anything human-like down there to incubate them. "Time for bed," the engineer told him. "Last shuttle's away, so we're ready to depart. You'll want to be in suspension before we stop rotation. Until we get our acceleration up, gravity's going to be all over the place." "What about you?"
"I'm chief engineer. I get to work through it, old man."
"Catching up on me?"
"Shut up."
As she helped him out of the chair, he felt his ribs complain. He had been told the suspension chamber would see him heal up nicely while he slept, and he fervently hoped it was true.
"Cheer up," Lane told him. "There'll be a whole treasure trove of ancient nonsense for you when you wake up. You'll be like a kid with new toys."
"Not if Guyon has anything to say about it," Halston grumbled. He spared a last look at the view screens, at the cold, pale orb of the prison moon. The colony moon, he corrected himself. His unworthy thought was, "Rather you than me." Leaning on Lane a little, he walked carefully off down the corridor, heading for the key crew sleep room. Chapter 3.12 A Voice in the Wilderness. The fallen giant had died, of course, but not for a long time. Until then, she, Portia and her kin found it difficult to conceive of this thing as anything other than a she, had dwelt in captivity, eating that limited selection of foods that she was willing to consume, staring out through the mist-coloured walls that kept her in, gazing up at the open top of her pen, where the scholars would gather to observe her. The dead giants were dissected and found to be essentially identical to mice in almost all internal structures, save for a difference of proportion in the limbs and certain organs. Comparative study confirmed their hypothesis that the living giant was probably a female, at least by comparison to its smaller endoskeletal cousins. The debate on its purpose and meaning, on the lesson that the arrival of such a prodigy was intended to teach, lasted for generations, over the whole span of the creature's long life and beyond. Its behaviour was strange and complex, but it seemed mute, producing no kind of gesture or vibration that could be considered an attempt at speech, Some noted that when it opened and closed its mouth, a cleverly designed web could catch a curious murmur, the same that might be felt when objects were pounded together. It was a vibration that travelled through the air, rather than across a strand or through the ground. For some time, this was hypothesized as a means of communication, provoking much intelligent debate. But in the end, the absurdity of such an idea won out. After all, using the same orifice for eating and communication was manifestly too inefficient. The spiders are not deaf exactly, but their hearing is deeply tied into their sense of touch and vibration. The giant's utterances, all the frequencies of human speech, are not even whispers to them. Anyway, the airborne vibrations grew fewer and fewer during the thing's captivity, and eventually it ceased to make them. Some suggested this meant the creature had grown content with its captivity. 2 generations after it was taken, when the events surrounding its arrival had already passed into something resembling theology, one attendant noticed that the giant was moving its extremities, the deft sublegs that it used to manipulate objects, in a manner imitative of palp signalling, as though it was trying to mimic the basic visual speech of the spiders. There was a renewed flurry of interest, and a great deal of visits from other nests and trading of understandings to enlighten future generations. Sufficient experimentation suggested that the giant was not simply copying what it saw, but that it could associate meaning with certain symbols, allowing it to request food and water. Attempts to communicate on a more sophisticated level were frustrated by its inability to approximate or comprehend more than a few very simple symbols. The baffled scholars, drawing on their species' accumulated years of study, concluded that the giant was a simple creature, probably designed to undertake labour suitable for a thing of its immense size and strength, but no more intelligent than a porcid beetle or a spitter, and perhaps less. Shortly after, the giant died, apparently of some infirmity. Its body was dissected and studied in turn, and compared to the genetically encoded understandings resulting from examinations of the original dead giants from generations earlier. Speculation as to its original purpose and connection with the messenger continued, with the most commonly held theory being that the messenger was served in the sky by a species of such giants, who performed necessary tasks for it. Therefore, in sending down its dumb emissaries so many years before, some manner of approbation had been intended. The inheritance of understandings placed something of a curb on the spiders' ability to mythologize their own history, but already the correlation of their victory over the ants and the arrival of the giants had become firmly accepted as somehow related. However, by the time this last giant died, the world of portion theology was already being rocked by another revelation. There was a second messenger. By that time, the war with the ants was long over. The porcid strategy had been successfully prosecuted against colony after colony until the spiders had reduced the insect's influence back to its original territory, where once an ancient Portia had raided their temple, stolen their idol, and unknowingly brought the word of the messenger to her own people. The scholars of Portia's kind had been keen not to reprogram the ant colony, as they had done with its various limbs and expeditionary forces, because in doing so its unique abilities would be lost, and the spiders were not blind to the advances that the colony's development had unlocked. So it was that years of complex campaigning had been entered into, at some considerable cost in lives, until the ant colony was manoeuvred into a position where cooperation with its spider neighbours became the most beneficial course of action, whereupon the ant colony passed, without acrimony or resentment, from an implacable foe to an obliging ally. The spiders were quick to experiment with the uses of metal and glass. Creatures of keen vision, their studies into light, refraction and optics followed swiftly. They learned to use carefully manufactured glass to extend the reach of their sight to the micro and macroscopic. The older generation of scholars passed the torch seamlessly to a new generation of scientists, who turned their newly augmented eyes to the night skies and viewed the messenger in greater detail, and looked beyond. At first, It was believed that the new message came from the messenger itself, but the astronomers quickly dispelled that notion. Working with the temple priestesses, they found that there was now another mobile point in the sky that could speak, and that its motion was slower and curiously irregular. Slowly, the spiders began to build up a picture of their solar system by reference to their own home, its moon and its messenger, the sun, and that outer planet which itself possessed an orbiting body that was sending out its own, separate signal. The one problem with this second message was that it was incomprehensible. Unlike the regular, abstractly beautiful numerical sequences that had become the heart of their religion, the new messenger broadcast only chaos, a shifting, changing, meaningless garble. Priestesses and scientists listened to its patterns, recorded them in their complex notation of knots and nodes, but could draw no meaning from them. Years of fruitless study resulted in a feeling that this new source of signal was some antithesis of the messenger itself, some almost malevolent source of entropy rather than order. In the absence of more information, all manner of curious intentions were credited to it. Then, a few years later, the second signal ceased to vary and settled on a single repeated transmission, over and over. And this again led to a mass of speculation across what had by then become a loose-knit global community of priest scientists. Again and again, the signal was passed for meaning, for surely a message repeated over and over so many times must be important. There was one curious school of thought that detected some manner of need in the signal, and quaintly fancied that out there through the unthinkable space between their world and the source of that second message, something lost and desperate was calling for help. Then the day came when the signal was no more, and the baffled spiders were left staring blankly up into a heaven suddenly impoverished, but unable to understand why. Part 4. Enlightenment. Chapter 4.1. The Cave of Wonders. When he was a child, Holston Mason had been mad about space. The exploration of Earth's orbit had been ongoing for a century and a half by then, and a generation of astronauts had been raiding the fallen colonies, from the lunar base to the gas giant moons. He had immersed himself in dramatic reconstructions of bold explorers entering dangerous, derelict space stations, avoiding the remaining automated systems to pillage tech and data from the burnt-out old computers. He had watched actual recordings of the real-life expeditions, often disturbing, often cut off suddenly. He remembered, at no more than 10 years old, seeing a helmet torch play over the vacuum-desiccated corpse of a millennia-old spaceman. By the time he was grown up, his interest had migrated back through time, from those bold scavenger pioneers to the lost civilization that they were rediscovering. Those days of discovery. So much had been hauled back down from orbit, but so little of it was understood. Alas, the golden days of the classicist were already on the wane when Holston had begun his career. He had lived to see his discipline steadily tainted by vicarious disgrace. There was less and less still to be gleaned from the scraps and splinters which the old empire had left behind. And it had become evident that those long-dead ancestors were still present in a malign, intangible way. The old empire was reaching out of deep history to inexorably poison its children. Small wonder that the study of that intricate, murderous people gradually lost its appeal. Now, at an inconceivable distance from his dying home, Holston Mason had been handed the veritable grail of the classicist. He sat in the comms room of the Gilgamesh, completely surrounded by the past, transmission after transmission filling the Arkship's virtual space with the wisdom of the ancients. As far as he was concerned, they had struck gold. He was one of the few key crew able to participate from the comfort of the Gilgamesh itself. Cast and Vetus had taken a shuttle and some drones to check out the barren-looking planet below them. Lane and her engineers were out on the half-finished station itself,
slowly proceeding down its compartmentalized length and recording everything they found. When they found working hardware they could access, they sent Holston the results, and he deciphered and catalogued it wherever he could, or put it aside for further study where he could not. Nobody had ever had access to an old Empire terraforming station before, even an incomplete one. Nobody had ever been sure that such a thing actually existed. Here, at the wrong end of his career, and at the wrong end of the history of the human race, Holston was finally in the undeniable position of being able to call himself the greatest expert ever on the old Empire. The thought was intoxicating, but its aftertaste one of bleak depression. Holston was now in possession of a greater trove of communications, fiction, technical manuals, announcements, and trivia in several imperial languages, but mostly Kern's Imperial Sea, than any scholar before him since the end of the Empire itself. All he could think was that his own people, an emergent culture that had clawed its way back to its feet after the ice, was nothing but a shadow of that former greatness. It was not simply that the Gilgamesh and all their current space effort was cobbled together from bastardized, half-understood pieces of the ancient world's vastly superior technology. It was everything. From the very beginning, his people had known they were inheriting a used world. The ruins and the decayed relics of a former people had been everywhere, underfoot, underground, up mountains, immortalized in stories. Discovering such a wealth of dead metal in orbit had hardly been a surprise, when all recorded history had been a progress over a desert of broken bones. There had been no innovation that the ancients had not already achieved, and done better. How many inventors had been relegated to historical obscurity because some later treasure hunter had unearthed the older, superior method of achieving the same end? Weapons, engines, political systems, philosophies, sources of energy. Holston's people had thought themselves lucky that someone had built such a convenient flight of steps back up from the dark into the sunlight of civilization. They had never quite come to the realization that those steps led only to that one place. Who knows what we might have achieved had we not been so keen to recreate all their follies, he thought now. Could we have saved the Earth? Would we be living there now on our own green planet? All the knowledge in the universe now at his fingertips. Yet, to that question, he had no answer. The Gilgamesh had translation algorithms now, mostly designed by Holston himself. Previously, the sum total of the ancient's written word had been so scarce that automatic deciphering had been infinitely hit and miss. He would still not have liked to have any conversation with Avarana Kern via a translation by the Gilgamesh, for example. Now, with a library of miscellanea at his fingertips, the computers were working with him to turn out at least halfway comprehensible versions of Imperial Sea. Most of the treasure trove of knowledge remained locked within ancient languages, though. Even with electronic help, there simply wasn't time to decode it all, and most likely the bulk of it was simply of no interest to anyone but himself. The best he could do was get an idea of what each separate file represented, catalogue it for future reference, and then pass on. Sometimes Lane or her people would contact him with questions, mostly about tech they had found but which seemed to serve no obvious purpose. They would give him vague search terms and send him digging through his own directories for something that might pertain to it. More often than not, his organisation and the wealth of material eventually yielded something of use, and he would set out a working translation of it. The fact that they could have looked for themselves was something he occasionally commented on, but it was plain that the engineers felt actually skimming Holston's catalogue was far more difficult than just pestering him about it. To be honest, he had hoped to get some talk of a more social nature with Lane, but in the 40 days he had been awake this time round, he had not so much as met her face to face. The engineers were busy, actually living out there on the great hollow cylinder of the station most of the time. They had thawed out and awoken an auxiliary crew of 30 trained people from cargo to help them, and still there was more work to be done than they could keep up with. 6 people had died, 4 to what had either been a working security system or a defective maintenance system, 1 to a suit malfunction, and 1 to sheer clumsiness,
by managing to get their suit cut open whilst trying to hurry equipment through a jagged gap in the station infrastructure. It was far less than those early exploration recordings would have led him to expect, but then there were no ancient dead here. No suggestion that this installation had fallen victim to the infighting that had brought down the Empire and its entire way of life. The long-ago engineers had simply departed, probably heading back for Earth when everything went wrong. This terraforming project they had begun had been left to the slow, heedless mercy of the stars. It could have been far worse. Lane had said the place had been poisoned, infected with some kind of electronic plague that had destroyed the original life support and a great deal of the station's core systems. The Gilgamesh had turned out to be too much of a poor imitation of the old Empire's elegant technology, though. Their technology had proved stony ground, the virtual attack frustrated by their primitive systems. Whether Kern had known and sent them into a trap was a subject of some debate amongst everyone except engineering, who had been tasked with jury-rigging as much of the station's systems as possible into giving up their secrets. A sound behind Holston brought him abruptly out of his reverie. It had been a quiet, stealthy sound, and for a moment he had a nightmare flash of memory of that distant green world with its giant arthropods. No monster, though. Behind him was only Guyan.
"It's all going well, I trust?"
the Ark ship commander inquired, regarding Holston as though suspecting him of something disloyal. He was leaner and greyer now than he had been when leaving the moon colony behind. Whilst Holston had slumbered peacefully, the commander had been waking up, on and off, to oversee the operation of his ship. Now he looked down on his chief classicist with an actual seniority in age to match his rank.
"Steadily,"
Holston confirmed, wondering what this visit was about. Guyan wasn't a man for pleasantries.
"I've been looking over your catalogue."
Holston fought down the temptation to express surprise at anyone doing such a thing, let alone Guyan.
"I've a list of items I want to read," the commander told him. "At your earliest convenience, of course. Engineering requests take precedence."
"Of course."
Holston tilted his head at the screen.
"Do you want to..."
Guyan passed over a tablet displaying half a dozen numbers entered neatly there, in the format of Holston's homegrown indexing system.
"Direct to me," he pressed.
He didn't actually say, "Don't tell anyone else about this," but everything in his manner hinted at it. Holston nodded mutely. The numbers gave him no suggestion as to what it was all about, or why any of this needed to be requested in person.
"Oh, and you might want to come listen. Vitas is going to tell us the news about the planet here, and how far along the terraforming got."
That would be welcome, and something Holston had been impatiently waiting for. Eagerly he got up and followed after Guyan. Enough of the secrets of the past for now. He wanted to hear a little more of the present and the future. Chapter 4.2 Death Comes Riding. Portia looks out across the vast, interconnected complexity that was Great Nest, and sees a city just beginning to die. In the last few generations, Great Nest's population has swelled to somewhere near 100,000 adult spiders, and countless, uncounted, young. It spreads through several square miles of forest, reaching from the earth to the canopy, a true metropolis of the spider age. The city Portia sees now is depopulated. Although the dying has only just started, hundreds of females are abandoning Great Nest for other cities. Others simply strike out into the remaining wilderness to take their chances, relying on centuries-old understandings to recapture the lifestyle of their ancient huntress ancestors. Many males have fled too. Already, the delicate structures of the city are showing some disrepair, as basic maintenance is disregarded. Plague is coming. In the north, a handful of great cities are already in ruins. A global epidemic is leaping from community to community. Hundreds of thousands are already dead from it, and now Great Nest has seen its own first victims. She knows this was inevitable, for this current Portia is a priestess and a scientist. She has been working to try and understand the virulent disease and to find a cure. She does not quite understand why this disease has had such an impact. Aside from its highly contagious nature and its ability to spread by contact, and somewhat less reliably through the air, the sheer concentration of bodies in the cities of Portia's people have turned a minor, controllable infection into something more virulent than the Black Death. Such great concentrations of bodies have led to all manner of squalor and health problems. Portia's people were only beginning to grasp the need for collective responsibility for such issues when the spread of the plague caught them unawares. Their casual, almost anarchic form of government is not well suited to taking the sort of harsh measures that might be effective. Another factor in the deadliness of the disease is the practice, increasingly common in the last century, of females choosing males born within their own peer group as mates, in an attempt to concentrate and control the spread of their understandings. This practice, well-meaning and enlightened in its way, has led to inbreeding that has weakened the immune systems of many powerful peer houses, meaning that those who might possess the power to take action are often first to come down with the plague when it erupts. Portia is aware of this pattern, though not the cause, and she is also aware that her own peer group fits that pattern all too well. She is aware that there are tiny animalcules associated with disease, but her magnifying lenses are not acute enough to detect the viral culprit for the plague. She has the results of experiments carried out by fellow scientists from other cities, many of whom are dead of the plague themselves, now. Some even arrived at a theory of vaccination, but the immune system of Portia's people is not the efficient and adaptive machine that humans and other mammals can boast. Exposure to a contagion simply does not prepare them for later kindred infections in the same way. The world is falling apart, and Portia is shocked at how little it has taken for this to occur. She had never realised that her whole civilization was such a fragile entity. She hears the news from other cities where the plague is already rife. Once the population begins to drop, from death and desertion, the whole structure of society collapses swiftly. The elegant and sophisticated way of life that the spiders have built for themselves has always been strung over a great abyss of barbarism, cannibalism, and a return to primitive, savage values. After all, they are predators at heart. She retreats to the temple, picking her way past the mass of citizens who have taken refuge therein, seeking some certainty from beyond. There are not as many as the day before. Portia knows this is not just because there are fewer of her people left in the city. She is also aware that there is a slowly growing disillusionment with the messenger and her message. "What good does it do us?" they ask. "Where is the fire sent from heaven to purge the plague?" Touching the crystal with her metal stylus, Portia dances to the music of the messenger as it passes overhead, her complex steps describing perfectly the equations and their solutions. As always, she is filled by that measureless assurance that something is out there, that just because she cannot understand something now does not mean that it cannot be understood. "One day I will comprehend you," is her thought directed to the messenger. But it rings hollow now. Her days are numbered. All their days are numbered. She finds herself entertaining the heretical thought, "If only we could send our own message back to you." The temple acts fiercely against that sort of thinking, but it is not the first time Portia has considered the idea. She is aware that other scientists, even priestess scientists, have been experimenting with some means of reproducing the invisible vibrations by which the message is spread. Publicly, the temple cannot condone such meddling, of course, but the spiders are a curious species, and those who are drawn to the temple are the most curious of all. It was inevitable that the hothouse flower of heresy would end up nurtured by those very guardians of the orthodox. On this day, Portia finds that she believes that if they could somehow speak across that vast and empty space to the messenger, then she would surely have an answer for them, a cure for the plague. Portia finds, just as inexorably, that no such dialogue is possible. No answer will come, and so she must find her own cure before it is too late. After Temple, she returns to her peer house, a great, sprawling, many-chambered affair slung between three trees, to meet with one of her males. Since the ravages of the plague began, the role of the male in spider society has changed subtly. Traditionally, the best lot in life for a male was to hitch his star to a powerful female and hope to be looked after. Or else, for those born with valuable understandings, to end up a pampered commodity in a seraglio, ready to be traded away or mated off as part of the constantly shifting power games between peer houses. Other than that, the lot of a male came down to being a kind of underclass of urban scavengers, constantly fighting each other over scraps of food, and always at risk without female patronage. However, from being a host of the useless and the unnecessary, decorative and fit for menial labour at best, a furtive meal at worst, they have become a desperate resource in time of need. Males are less independent, less able to fend for themselves out in the wilds, and so they tend to stay when females flee. That Great Nest and many other cities remain functioning at all is due to the number of males who have taken the chance to step into traditionally female roles. There are even male warriors, hunters and guards now, because someone must take up the sling and the shield and the incendiary grenade, and often there is nobody else to do so. Females in Portia's position have long had their pick of male escorts, and whilst some keep them about merely to dance attendance, literally, and add to a female's apparent importance, others have trained them as skilled assistants. The Bianca of old, with her male laboratory assistants, had uncovered something of a truth about spider gender politics when she complained that working with females involved far too much competition for dominance, and old instincts lie shallowly under the civilized surface. This current Portia, too, has come reluctantly to trust in males. Not long ago, she sent out a band of males, a gang of adventurers that she had made frequent use of before. They were all capable, used to working together from their youngest days as abandoned spiderlings on the streets of Great Nest. Their mission was one that Portia felt no female would accept. Their reward was to be the continued support of Portia's peer group. Food, protection, access to education, entertainment, and culture. One of them has returned. Just the one. Call him Fabian. He comes to her now at the pier house. Fabian is missing a leg, and he looks half-starved and exhausted. Portia's palps flick, sending one of the immature males from the creche to find some food for them both. Well? An impatient twitch as she watches him.
Conditions are worse than you thought. Also, I had difficulty re-entering Great Nest. Travellers suspected of coming from the north are being turned away, if female. Killed out of hand, if male.
His speech is a slow shuffle of feet, slurred and uneven.
Is that what happened to your comrades?
No. I am the only one to return. They're all dead. Such a brief eulogy, this, for those that he had spent most of his life with. But then it is well known in Portia's society that males do not really feel with the same acuity as females, and certainly they cannot form the same bonds of attachment and respect. The juvenile male returns with food, trussed live crickets, and vegetable polyps gathered from the farms. Gratefully, Fabian scoops up one of the bound insects and inserts a fang. Too exhausted to bother using venom, he sucks the spasming creature dry.
There are survivors in the plague cities, as you had thought, he continues as he eats, but they retain nothing of our ways. They live like beasts, merely spinning and hunting. There were females and males. My companions were taken and devoured, one by one.
Portia stamps anxiously.
But were you successful?
Fabian's ordeal has sufficiently affected him that he does not immediately respond to her inquiry, but asks back, "Are you not worried that I might have brought the plague to Great Nest? It seems likely I must have contracted it. It is already here." His palps flex slowly, in a gesture of resignation. "I have succeeded. I have brought 3 spiderlings, taken from the plague zone. They are healthy. They are immune, as those living there must be. You were right, for what good it may do us." "Take them to my laboratory," she instructs him. Then, seeing his remaining limbs tremble, she continues, "After that, the peer house is yours to roam. You will be rewarded for this great service. Merely ask for whatever you wish." He regards her eye to eye, a bold move. But he was always a bold male, and why else would he have made such a useful tool? "Once I have rested, I would assist you in your work, if you would let me," he tells her. "You know I have understandings of the biochemical sciences, and I have studied also." The offer surprises Portia, who shows it in her posture. "Great Nest is my home too," Fabian reminds her. "All I am is contained here. Do you truly believe that you can defeat the plague?" "I believe that I must try, or we're all lost anyway." A somber thought, but the logic is undeniable. Chapter 4.3 Notes from a Grey Planet. Holston was taken aback by the number of people who had gathered to hear the news. The Gilgamesh was short of auditoriums, so the venue was a converted shuttle bay, bare and echoing. He wondered if the absent shuttles were currently clamped to the derelict station, or whether this was where he and Lane had been kidnapped and brought to by the mutineers. All the bays looked the same, and any damage had presumably been repaired by now. In his solitary labours, he had lost track of just how many people had been woken up to assist with the reclamation effort. At least 100 were sitting around the hangar, and he was struck with an almost phobic response to them. Too many, too close, too enclosed. He ended up hovering next to the doorway, realizing that some part of his mind had resigned itself to a future of dealing only with a few other humans, and had perhaps preferred that. And why are we all here, anyway? There was no actual requirement for physical attendance, after all. He himself could have continued his work and watched Vetus's presentation on a screen, or had her warbling away in his ear. Nobody needed to shift their pounds of flesh over here just to trust to their antiquated eyes and ears. Vetus herself had no practical need to give a presentation in person. Even back home, this sort of academic status-mongering had been conducted at a distance most of the time. So why? And why did I come? Looking over the crowd gathered there, hearing the murmur of their excited conversation, he could speculate that many of them must have come just to be sociable, to be with their fellows. But that's not me, is it? And he realized that it was, of course. He was tethered inextricably to a social species, however much he might fancy himself as a loner. There was, even in Holston, a desire to interact with other human beings, preserving a bond between himself and everyone else here. Even Vitas was present, not for scholarly prestige or for status amongst the crew, but because she needed to reach out and know there was something she could reach out to. Looking over the crowd, Holston could see few familiar faces. Aside from Vitas's own science team, most of key crew were occupied on the station, and almost everyone here had last opened their eyes way back on Earth, so could know nothing of Kern, or the Green Planet, or its terrible inhabitants, save what they were told, or from what unclassified material was available in the Guild's records. Whilst it was true that a lot of them were young, it was the knowledge gap that made him feel old, as though he had been awake for centuries longer than they, rather than just a few strung-out days passed in another solar system. Guyon had found a place at the back, keeping similarly aloof, and now Vetus stepped forward, precise and fastidious, looking over her audience as though not entirely sure she had come into the right room. The screen her team had installed, taking up much of the wall behind her, shifted from a dead,
to a lambent grey. Vitas regarded it critically, and then managed a thin smile.
As you know, I have been overseeing a survey of the planet that we are currently in orbit around. It seems unarguable now,
and she was good enough to throw a tiny nod Holston's way,
that we have arrived at one of a string of terraforming projects that the old Empire was pursuing immediately before its dissolution. The previous project we saw was complete, and under a quarantine imposed for unknown purposes by an advanced satellite. As we are discovering, work at our current location appears to have been arrested during the terraforming process itself, and the control facility abandoned. I'm aware that engineering has been undertaking the formidable task of investigating that facility, whilst I have been investigating the planet itself to see if it might serve us in any fashion as a home.
There was nothing in this clipped, dry delivery to give any clue as to her conclusions, if conclusions there were. This was not showmanship, or a desire for suspense, simply that Vitas considered herself a pure scientist first and foremost, and would report positive and negative results with equal candour, without judging the value or desirability of the outcome. Holston was familiar with that particular academic school, which had grown more and more popular towards the end on Earth, as positive results became harder to find. Vitas looked out over the gathering, and Holston tried to interpret her expression, her body language, anything to get an idea of where this was going. Do we stay here? Are we heading onwards? Are we going back? That last possibility was his major concern, for he was one of the very small number who had first-hand experience of Kern's green world. The screen brightened, grey to grey to grey, and then there was the curve of a dark horizon, and they were now looking at the grey planet.
As you will have remarked, the surface of this planet seems curiously uniform. Spectrographic analysis, however, shows abundant organic chemistry, all the elements we might need to survive, Vitas told them. We dropped a pair of drones as soon as we had established a high orbit. The images that you'll be seeing are all taken from drone camera. The colours are the true colours, with no touching up or artistic licence.
Holston wasn't seeing any colours, unless grey counted. But as sunrise crept across the orb displayed before him, he saw contours, shadows, indications of mountains, basins, channels.
As you can see, this planet is geologically active, which may have been a prerequisite for the Empire's terraforming. We don't know whether this is simply because, of all the Earth-like qualities they wish to find in a new world, that would be the most difficult to fabricate, perhaps outright impossible. Or alternatively, that they have indeed instilled that quality into the planet at an early stage. Hopefully, the recovered information from the station will give us an idea of how they went about the process. It is within the bounds of possibility that one day we ourselves may be able to duplicate the feat.
And there was at least a hint there that Vitas was feeling a little excited by the thought. Holston was sure her voice lifted a semitone, that one of her eyebrows even twitched.
You can see here the drone readings of the basic conditions planet side, Vitas continued. So, gravity around 80% of Earth's, a slow rotation giving around a 400-hour diurnal cycle, temperature is high, bearable around the poles, survivable in northern latitudes, but probably not within human tolerance towards the equator. You'll note that oxygen levels are only around 5%, so no easy home here, I'm afraid. A salutary lesson, nonetheless, as you will see.
The image shifted to a much closer view of the surface, with the drones flying far lower, and a ripple went through the audience, one of bafflement, disquiet. The grey was alive. The entire surface, as far as the drone camera could register, was covered in a dense, interlaced vegetation, grey as ashes. It feathered out into fern-like fronds that arched over each other, spreading hand-like folds to catch the sunlight. It erupted into phallic towers that were warty with buds or fruiting bodies. It covered the mountains to their very tips. It formed a thick, grey fur on every visible surface. The image shifted and shifted
and Vetus noted different locations, with an inset global map showing where the views were taken from. The details of the view, however, barely changed.
"What you are looking at is best thought of as a fungus," the science chief explained. "This solitary species has colonized the entire planet, pole to pole, and at every altitude. Scans of the underlying ground, as overlain here, show that the actual topography of the planet is as varied as one might expect of a substitute Earth. There are sea basins, but no seas, river valleys, but no rivers. Investigation suggests that there is a planet's worth of water bound up in that organism you see before you. And it may even be a single organism. There's no obvious division observable. It appears capable of some manner of photosynthesis, despite the colour, but the low oxygen levels suggest this is chemically distinct from anything we're familiar with. It's not known whether this pervasive species is somehow an intended part of the terraforming process, or if it was the result of an error, and its irremovable presence led the engineers to abandon their work, or whether it has arisen after that abandonment, the natural byproduct of a part-completed job. In any event, I think it's safe to say that the stuff is there to stay. This is now its world.
Can it be cleared? Someone asked. Can we burn it back or something?
Vetus's outward calm had at last been ruffled. Good luck burning anything with that little oxygen, she tutted. Besides, I'm recommending no further investigation of this planet. By the time we had established the position down there and conducted some exploratory research, the drones were beginning to show signs of reduced functionality. We kept them going for as long as we were able, but both of them eventually ceased working altogether. The air down there is virtually a spore soup. New fungal colonies looking to sprout on any fresh surface that becomes exposed. Which reminds me, with all the excitement within this system and the last, we need to construct more drones in the workshops once the resources are available. We have very few of them left.
Granted, Guyan replied from the back. Get on to it. I think we can assume this place isn't going to be our home any time soon, he added. But that's not going to be a problem. Our priority is to gather everything we can from the station, file it, translate it, and work out what we can put into action. At the same time, we're undertaking a major overhaul of the Gilgamesh's own systems, repairing and replacing where we can. There's a lot of usable tech on that station if we can find a way to splice it to our own. And don't worry about not being able to go live on Fungus World. I have a plan. There is a plan. With what we found here, we can go and take our birthright.
The speech veered into the messianic so abruptly that even Guyan himself seemed surprised for a moment. But then he turned and departed, curious conversation welling up in his wake. Chapter 4.4 Inquiring Minds. The plague is insidious at first, then tyrannous, and at last truly terrifying. Its symptoms are by now well recorded, reliably predictable. Everything, in fact, except preventable. The first sure signs are a feeling of heat in the joints, a rawness at the eyes, mouth parts, spinnerets, anus, and book lungs. Muscle spasms, especially in the legs, follow. At first just a few. A stammering in speech. A nervous dance not quite accounted for. Then more and more the victim's limbs are not her own, leading her in babbling, staggering, whole frantic, meaningless journeys. Around this time, from 10 to 40 days after the first involuntary twitch, the virus reaches the brain. The victim then relinquishes her grasp on who and where she is. She perceives those around her in irrational ways. Paranoia, aggression, and fugue states are common during this phase. Death follows in another 5 to 15 days, immediately preceded by an irresistible desire to climb as high as possible. Fabian has recounted in some detail the dead city that he has visited once more. The highest reaches of the trees and the decaying webbing were crowded with the rigid carapaces of the dead, glassy eyes fixed upwards on nothing. Prior to those first definitive symptoms,
The virus is present in the victim's system for an unknown period, but often as long as 200 days, while slowly infiltrating the patient's system without any obvious harm. The victim feels occasional periods of heat or dizziness, but there are other potential causes for this, and the episodes usually go unreported. All the more so because, prior to the disease taking hold in Great Nest, as it now has, any suspected sufferers were exiled on pain of death. Those incubating the disease were part of an inadvertent conspiracy to mask the signs of outbreak for as long as possible. During this early, innocent-seeming phase, the disease is moderately contagious. Being close to a sufferer for an extended period of time is very likely to lead to oneself contracting the disease, although bites from deranged victims in their last phases are the surest way to become infected. There have been half a dozen late-stage victims in Great Nest. They are killed on site and at range. There are three times as many lingering in the mid-stage, and so far no consensus has been reached regarding them. Portia and others are insistent that a cure is possible. There is a tacit agreement amongst the temple scientists to conceal just how little idea they have of what can be done. Portia is making the best uses of Fabian's prizes that she can. The spiderlings came from the plague city, and she can only hope that this means they are immune to the plague, and that this immunity will somehow be amenable to study. She has tested them, and taken samples of their hemolymph, their arachnid blood, to examine. But all her lenses and analyses have so far discovered nothing. She has ordered that fluids from the spiderlings be fed or injected into mid-stage victims, a manner of transfusion having been pioneered just a few years before. The limited immune system of the spiders means that blood type rejection is far less of an issue. In this case, the attempt has had no effect. In working with sufferers, in order to preserve herself as long as possible from the inevitable moment when she becomes her own test subject, she has used Fabian, and he has liaised with the males within those peer houses where the plague has taken hold. It is known that males are a little hardier than females where the plague is concerned. Ironically, ancient genetics link the elegance and stamina of their wooing dances with the strength of their immune systems, keeping a constant pressure on natural selection. Everything that Portia has tried has so far failed, and none of her fellows has obtained any better results. She's beginning to drift into ever more speculative sciences, desperate for that one lateral thought that will save her civilization from a collapse into dispersed barbarism. She has now been working in her laboratory for the best part of a day. Fabian has departed with a new batch of solutions to pass to his counterparts within the sealed lazar houses that the dwellings of infected peer groups have become. She has no particular belief that these solutions will work. She feels she has reached the end of her capabilities, frustrated with the great void of ignorance that she has found, while standing out here at the very edge of her people's comprehension. She now has a visitor. Under other circumstances, she would turn this one away, but she is tired, so very tired, and she desperately needs some new perspective. And new, disturbingly new, perspectives are what this visitor is all about. Her name is Bianca, and she was formerly one of Portia's peer group. She is a large, overfed spider with pale brindling all over her body, who moves with a fidgety, nervous energy that makes Portia wonder whether, if Bianca caught the disease, anyone would actually notice. Bianca was formerly of the temple too, but she did not fulfil her duties with the proper respect. Her curiosity as a scientist overwhelmed her reverence as a priestess. She had begun experiments with the crystal, and when this was discovered, she came very close to being exiled for her disrespect. Portia and her other peers interceded on her behalf, but she effectively fell from those lofty levels of society, losing both her status and her friends. It was assumed that she would leave Great Nest, or perhaps die. Instead, somehow Bianca has clung on, and even thrived. She has always been a brilliant mind. Perhaps that is another reason Portia, at the end of her own mental resources, lets her in. And she has bartered her skills like a male,
by serving lesser peer houses, and eventually forming a new peer group of her own, drawn from other disaffected scholars. In better times, the major peer houses were always on the point of censuring or exiling the entire clutch of them, but now nobody cares. Portia's people have other matters to concern them.
They say you are close to a cure.
However, Bianca's stance and the slight delay in her movements convey scepticism very neatly.
I work. We all work.
Portia would normally exaggerate her prospects, but she is feeling too weary.
Why are you here?
Bianca shuffles slyly, eyeing Portia.
Why, sister, why am I ever anywhere?
This is not the time. So Bianca is after her usual, then. Portia huddles miserably, the other spider stepping close to hear.